If I have to make the sound of a neuron one more time, I'm going to throw myself out the window.
Yes, sometimes even Jad Abumrad, the host of Radiolab, a show that's equal parts cosmic exploration, science lesson, and sound-rich storytelling, gets a little restless. That's why he launched a new podcast called More Perfect, which he'll be discussing live in Lexington this week. I got a chance to chat with the radio pioneer about what drives his imagination and what he hopes to bring to audiences. Jad Abumrad, thanks for talking with us.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Well, you are slated to deliver the Edward F. Pritchard Lecture at the University of Kentucky this Friday. I want to get to that in a bit, but first, let's give listeners a little sketch of your background and how you came to be where you are now. So maybe chart a little bit of that course for us. I know it started not too far from here in Nashville, yes?
It did, yeah. I grew up in Nashville for the, let's see, well, you don't care exactly when, but 18 years I lived in Nashville. And, you know, I start in Nashville, you know, I was sort of this scrawny Arab kid in a Southern Baptist universe. And so I spent a lot of time in my room playing with a little four-track cassette recorder and making kind of imaginary film scores for movies that didn't exist. And I sort of launched myself into the world and into college and beyond, thinking that that's what I would do. I'd be a musician. I would write music for films. And subsequently, I tried that. Didn't really work. It turns out I wasn't great at it. And, you know, I had a little bit of a crisis about 5 or 6 years after college, and ended up just on a lark, volunteering at a local public radio station, just doing odd jobs, and kind of got the bug. And I don't know, 5 or 6 years into just doing those odd jobs, Radiolab happened. Actually, it wasn't 5 or 6 years, but let's say 3 years into it, Radiolab just became a show very early, before I was ready. And then it was a long and slow evolution. You know, I'd say the show began in about 2002, very, very early. And there was 3 or 4 years before anyone really heard it, where I was just trying to figure out my voice. But interestingly enough, I mean, the thing that Radiolab is often known for these days is the way that we use sound. And for me, that was a real discovery, that the thing I thought I would be doing, which was music and scoring, turned out to actually be the thing I'm doing now, except I'm doing it with ideas and with science and storytelling, but also with the sounds and the stuff. So it's interesting. I feel like I kind of stumbled into what I wanted to do through the side door.
There is this feeling on Radiolab in pretty much every episode of two guys just encountering a question and then setting off into new territory and kind of letting it take you where it takes you. And from reading some of your interviews, it sounds like kind of similar to the trajectory you've taken in your career. Is that safe to say?
Yeah. I mean, it was all really super organic. I mean, the modern version of Radiolab, which was sort of Robert and I, it began... I mean, this is true of everything in my career. Somehow I just kind of I wander into it, and then it's happening before I even know what it is. So I met Robert really early on. I had started Radiolab, but it was sort of marooned on the AM station on Sunday nights in New York. So it was, no one was listening, literally no one, because I would later discover that, like, there's this weird property that AM radio waves have where they will bounce off the water and land in Canada, and the Canadians get mad at us, and so they mandate that we cut the power on our signal at exactly the moment that my show comes on. And so you couldn't actually even tune in my show because the power was so weak. Anyhow, so I was doing a show. No one was listening. And I justified the existence of Radiolab in those early days by doing odd jobs around the station, making myself as useful as possible to the people at WNYC. And so I would make promos for them, like fundraising promos, anything I could think of. And one day they sent me out to record a bunch of people who were well-known supporters of the station reading these 30-second promos, and Robert was on the list. And, you know, because he was a well-known reporter at that point. And I remember I handed him a script to read, and he didn't want to read it. I now am very familiar with that that instinct in him. He's like, no, I'm not going to read that. I'm going to make something up. And so he then turned around and wrote some crazy thing about alien cults and oil tycoons, and I don't know what it was. It was so weird that I was fascinated. I was like, well, who is this guy? And so we started talking, and turned out that he had gone to Oberlin like I had gone to Oberlin, but 25 years before me. He had worked at this community station that I had just worked at, WBAI. He had then worked at NPR. He was one of the people who started NPR, and I was just doing a little freelancing for them. And it was really interesting. We had all these kind of symmetries. Like, I was like an echo of him 25 years later. So we started having breakfast, just randomly having breakfast once or twice a month. And meanwhile, I'm making this show called Radio Lab. He hasn't heard it. At some point, he does hear it and is interested. And so what we ended up doing was taking our breakfast conversations and kind of putting them on the air, because we would have these really animated breakfasts where I would tell him something I just learned and he would tell me something he just learned. And when we were then in the studio, I think we both just sort of projected the memory of those breakfasts and filtered the studio through that. And it was suddenly like we were just still having breakfast, but in a new environment. And so it's weird to me that Radiolab, in some sense, was invented not at WNYC, but on 66th and Broadway, where there was this diner. And so that is, for me, like everything that has ever happened to me. It somehow happened not in the way I would have ever expected.
You mentioned working with sound, and you know, I know how long it takes to put together a typical news package, but every week I'm listening to Radiolab and thinking, my God, like the editing, the Foley work, like how long does this take?
Oh, it can take a long, long time. I mean, the editing used to take the longest time, longest part of the process. You know, if you have all the interviews recorded, it can take you 3-4 weeks of just editing them together, composing the music, trying to get it to feel right in the way just the way you want to feel. But these days, actually, to be honest, I mean, Radiolab has changed over the years, and we've become a very kind of almost investigative show. You know, so often we'll be like, we just did a border trilogy, a triptych of stories about the history of the U.S. southern border with Mexico. And I'd say we worked on that maybe a year, 18 months from start to finish. I remember one of our reporters did a story that followed a big game hunter to Namibia, and it ended up being a big sort of investigation of conservation and trophy hunting. That took two years, start to finish. You know, these stories can take anywhere from a few months to, you know, multiple years. And these days, the longest part of the process is finding the story and reporting the story and fact-checking the story. And then the editing and the cutting and the music all sort of get smashed into about the last 2 to 3 weeks or maybe a month.
That's a lot to do there, especially just for one episode. To shift gears a little bit, you've also got this podcast, More Perfect, taking Supreme Court cases kind of from the abstract to the specific, where they affect people's lives. Was there a particular case or event that jump-started that interest for you?
Yeah, there was. 2012, at this point, I had been making Radiolab for about 8-9 years. And, you know, Radiolab grew out of a restlessness, you know, wanting to try things, wanting to sort of experiment. And I continually, as we were making the show, I would want to change and try new things based on that same restlessness. And in 2012, I was really getting tired of doing a very particular kind of story that we had developed, which was sort of the science meets big ideas kind of moment of wonder story, where like maybe you meet a scientist, they tell you about a study, and then the study leads you to some profound observation about the world, and then cue music, right? So we were doing a lot of those kinds of stories where they were like deep, deep cinematic kind of explorations of science. And I remember, like, there was one day when I was sitting there sound designing the sound of a neuron firing and thinking to myself, Jesus, I have done this very same thing 5 times. And if I have to make the sound of a neuron one more time, I'm going to throw myself out the window. So I was like, I was in that mind space. So I decided, okay, we've got to like expand our repertoire. We've got to try something new, something that we're really, really bad at. And it just so happened that that day, the Supreme Court had released its docket of cases that it was going to see over the next few months. And I was like, oh, okay, here are all these cases. I know nothing about any of these cases. I know nothing about the Supreme Court. But it was interesting to me that they just told you what they were going to look at. So I basically took that with very little thinking, and I put it in front of the staff at an editorial meeting. And I was like, listen, here are 10 cases. I want each of you to make one call. Pick a case, make one call, report back. Let's see where we get. So they go off and do that. And then at the meeting, most of the people didn't find anything interesting. But there was one guy, a guy by the name of Tim Howard, who then went off many years later to work on a great podcast called Reply All. But Tim Howard had chosen this case that was named, confusingly, adoptive couple v. baby girl. And it was... On the surface, it seemed like your basic custody battle. You had this couple that was trying to adopt a young girl, but then at the very last minute, the biological father kind of swept in and claimed custody. And so it was really a fight between this couple that was adopting and the biological dad. This 2-year-old girl was in the middle. But oddly enough, attached to the fate of this 2-year-old girl were massive questions about the sovereignty of 500 some odd Native American sovereign nations. And attached to that was an incredible history of our relationship to these tribes, and this whole period in the 1950s and 60s where you had people driving onto Native American reservations and literally kidnapping children. It was fascinating to hear Tim talk about the case and then peel back a layer and talk about these big legal questions about sovereignty and then peel back a layer and talk about the history of our relationship to these tribes and then to peel back yet even another layer and just to talk about the experience of these people because he had spoken to them on the phone. And so it was amazing. I was like, wow, look, look at all of the things that exist in this one case. And it's all hinging on the fate of this 1 2-year-old girl. And it was amazing to me. And like we always, often at Radiolab, we talk about like, what do you want from a story? And like, you want the universe in a blade of grass in this kind of Whitman-esque way. Like you want one tiny thing to encompass everything. And it seemed to me like just like there it was. One small 2-year-old girl encompasses so many fates and so many questions. And to make a long story short, too late, we ended up putting that story on the air, and I was like, this is amazing. Like, I don't know any of this history. I don't know any of this law, any of the political questions here. But just as a storyteller, it was fascinating to me that you could... here was a lens through which to see so many different aspects of America. And so we did it again. And we did it another time. And then I think we did it a third time and a fourth time. We ended up doing a whole hour on the legal foundation for the war on terror. I got really interested in the law because, again, just something I know nothing about. And eventually that turned into More Perfect. It just became its own show. But it really was born out of, I guess, this restlessness and this desire to... I don't know. I mean, this is going to sound corny, but be a better citizen, kind of know the backstory of this country in a way that I just feel like I was never taught in school.
It seems like podcasts in particular have just really opened up this new space for people to step back from the soundbite-driven, 5-minute segments you see on cable news and really let subjects breathe again. And it seems like, from my end anyway, there is a real hunger for that. What kind of reaction do you get from listeners?
Yeah, I mean, I see that too. You know, I think people want, I mean, the wonderful thing about a podcast is that there aren't those same time constraints that you get in broadcasting. You know, I mean, as you well know, like on the radio, the clock rules everything. I mean, if you've got a segment, it has to be 5 minutes or 7 minutes if it's going to fit in the C segment, because you've got all these other things that have to fill out the hour with it. In a podcast, you know, if you hit a really great conversation, you can let it go 50 minutes. Or if it's kind of a boring conversation, you let it go 6 minutes. I mean, time is entirely dictated by the content rather than the clock. And that's pretty amazing. And so, you know, we allow ourselves the time and the space to go really, really stupidly deep on stuff. And, you know, if you can do that and you can make it compelling and you can make it exciting and visceral and you can really make people feel like this is something they need to know that they can't turn away from. I mean, people are just so grateful. You know, not every story hits all those notes. I think particularly when you're talking about something like the Supreme Court, which everybody expects to be deadly boring. If you can take that stuff and make it as exciting as it actually is, if you can kind of shed the expectations, people are like, oh my God, I'm so happy to know this thing. And that's really great. It's because that's where it starts for me. I want to have that experience that I ultimately want the listener to have.
So you are slated to talk here in Lexington. Without giving too much away, maybe you can give us a taste of what attendees will hear this week.
Sure. I mean, you know, this is an interesting one for me. This is a chance for me to sit on a stage with a dean of the University of Kentucky Libraries to talk. Her name's Deidre Skaggs. She and I are going to talk about More Perfect. And she's going to ask me some questions about where it came from, how should we all be thinking about the Supreme Court right now? I mean, obviously, we've all just gone through this like insane episode in the Kavanaugh confirmation hearing, but just sort of moving forward, what kind of cases are coming down the pike? How should we think about them? How do you tell stories about the Supreme Court? You know, I think she's going to ask me those kinds of questions, and so this is my chance to really talk about this passion project and about my own journey in figuring out, you know, why the Supreme Court matters. And yeah, so I think that people will hear, you know, if I had to guess, like we just did a new project that I won't, no spoilers, but it involves Dolly Parton. So people might hear a little Dolly Parton clip being played. We might talk about a story that we reported that's very local to you guys. So there might be that. I don't know. It's going to be great. I think it's going to be really, really fun.
So before I let you go, being an amateur philosophy nerd who is always curious about this stuff, if you had to pick your top three philosophers who've influenced you or maybe taken you in the most interesting directions, who would they be?
Wow. I love that question. Okay. Wow. Top three philosophers. Well, all right. Let me think. Okay. I'm going to define philosophers broadly here. I would say number one, Wittgenstein. Really difficult philosopher to read, not the most like pleasurable, easy on the page, but he had this idea called, about the power of language to define reality. Like, you know, this notion of language games that he invented, which is that each place, each profession, each occupation, each location, has within it its own language game, and those in some sense define the perimeters of those universes. In the same way that we all intuitively know that the conversation you have at the dinner table is a very different conversation than the conversation you have around a conference room table, right? Each of those has their own language games attached to it. In the same way that public radio has a language game, a certain way that we speak to our listeners versus, say, a pilot the way that the pilots speak to you as you're taking off in that very kind of right stuff way with the voice kind of low, they have their own language game. His thinking about that is, I come back to it again and again and again, because when I'm trying to communicate something like science, difficult science to a group of people who would otherwise not want to know it, I think about language games, like what are the words and the rules around the way that I speak here that will allow me to translate? What are the words I should avoid? What are the words I should lean into? Those kinds of things. So Wittgenstein on language games. I think about Kierkegaard on uncertainty. He had a wonderful, he wrote beautifully about this sort of how to live and through periods of deep uncertainty. He wrote a beautiful story about the story of Abraham, interpreting that as a, anyhow, I won't bore you with the details. But anyhow,
is so this fear and trembling?
Yes, exactly. So, so Kierkegaard would be another one. I don't know. Would Jung be a philosopher? Not so much.
Yeah,
no,
well,
but
we're talking broadly.
Yeah, okay. His idea of the collective unconscious is something that I think about a lot. Weirdly, when I'm scoring a piece of radio, I often think of the music as the collective unconscious. Like, it is the thing that that combines all of the sort of unspoken desires and thoughts and feelings that are bubbling under the surface. It is, in some sense, the ocean upon which the tiny little boat that is the story floats. And so I think of the I think of the music as somehow embodying all of the sort of unspoken, and that helps me sort of make the right choices musically. I want the music to somehow know things about the story that the characters in the story don't know. And so I think about Jung when I'm scoring. God, that sounded so pretentious, but that's an honest answer.
Well, I've been chatting with radio host, composer, producer, all-around Renaissance man, Jad Abumrad. You can catch him live and in person at UK's Gatton College building at 5:30 this Friday. Thanks for chatting with us. It was a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you for having me.